The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Former NEA Chairman Bill Ivey is the guest this week, and we discuss his March 13th, 2016 email to Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta, an email that WikiLeaks recently published, along with thousands of other emails from the Clinton campaign. Here's a short excerpt from that email. "We've all been quite content to demean government, drop civics, and in general, conspire to produce an unaware and compliant citizenry. The unawareness remains strong, but compliance is obviously fading rapidly. It's Thursday, October 27th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Before we begin, I want to thank all the members of the Zero Books Club. Last week's members-only Inside Zero Books podcast wasn't members-only. It featured a conversation with my son Benjamin, who is a junior at the University of Oregon, and he was taking a course entitled Culture, Capitalism, and Globalization. And if you haven't heard it already, you're free to check it out. It's free to everyone. I encourage you to go by the Zero Books blog and listen. The Zero Books Club gives members access to weekly Inside Zero Books podcasts, which serve as the second hour of the Zero Books podcast that you get for free every week. This second hour usually features conversations about the left and left publishing with members of the Zero Books editorial team. You'll hear from Ashley Frowley, C. Derek Varn, Alfie Bound, and every once in a while, guests like my son Benjamin, as we discuss political theory and the ups and downs of radical publishing within a clickbait culture. Inside Zero Books will also feature interviews with radical thinkers and authors from around the world, and the next Inside Zero Books podcast will feature clips from this conversation with Bill Ivey that ended up on the cutting room floor, as well as a conversation with Alfie Bound. This episode of Zero Squared includes a clip from the 1997 film Bullworth, a computerized reading of Neera Tanden's email to John Podesta that's dated January 20th, 2016, and an excerpt from MIA's song WikiLeaks. Right now you're listening to a karaoke version of Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop, but in just a moment you'll be listening to Bill Ivey and I discuss compliant citizens and demeaned governments. Bill Ivey was appointed as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts by President Bill Clinton in 1998. He is the author of Engaging Art, The Next Great Transformation of America's Cultural Life, published by Routledge; Arts Incorporated, How Greed and Neglect Have Destroyed Our Cultural Rights, published by the University of California Press; and A Confidential Memo to Hillary Clinton's Campaign Chairman John Podesta, published by WikiLeaks. So, Bill Ivey, thank you for coming on to the Zero Books podcast.
My pleasure.
To start with, I just want to ask you about this WikiLeaks email that you wrote. It was picked up by a lot of right-wing outlets and publications. You said a few things in the email that were taken out of context or misunderstood. I want to give you a chance to clarify what you meant when you wrote about, let me just read this. "As I've mentioned, we've all been quite content to demean government, drop civics, and in general conspire to produce an unaware and compliant citizenry. The unawareness remains strong, but compliance is obviously fading rapidly. This problem demands some serious thinking and not just poll-driven, demographically inspired messaging." So I think you were taken to mean the exact opposite of what you obviously meant. But what did you mean when you wrote that?
Well, John Podesta and I go back a while. You know, when I was chairman of the NEA, he, in effect, was my boss. He was the chief of staff in the Bill Clinton White House. And then John started the Center for American Progress in 2002 or three and brought me on as a trustee. And I'm still a trustee of the center. And so John and I have had a conversation about these issues over the years. And one of the things that I bring up in every center trustees meeting is that I really think the Washington establishment, and I think of pundits and experts and lobbyists and other characters in the D.C. scene, have been too content to just talk to one another, too content to make policy without really engaging what the American people think, and to approach the electorate and the citizenry, you know, every 2 years or 4 years when there's an election, and sort of say, well, you know, you're Hispanic American, you should vote this way. We understand that you're African American, so you should vote this way, and kind of engage the public demographically. And then once the vote is complete, then everybody goes back to D.C. and starts making the rules again without talking to the American people or engaging them on a routine, regular basis or really caring about what they're thinking, apart from these sort of massive, measurable trends. So I was lamenting the fact that even Democrats, and I think most of this has come from the Republican side, but even Democrats neglect real contact with the American people. We too often don't really listen. And so I think that's, to a certain extent, to use the U.S. expression, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost after 20 or 25 years of not paying attention. And at the same time, not teaching civics, not really trying to build a knowledgeable electorate that respects what government can do. You know, then we've allowed people to just say, well, government workers are lazy or they're incompetent. Elected officials are all kind of venal. And again, it's mostly come from the Republican side, but not entirely. And by denigrating government and not teaching civics, pretty soon you open up the opportunity for a really disruptive election of the kind that we're having right now. So my intent with John was to, you know, kind of continue the conversation we'd had about what we could do better. And I'm hoping that post-election, and I think this is being talked about more broadly right now at long last, mm-hmm. that there should be a way of bringing right and left together to talk about how we can repair the relationship between the American people and their own government.
So when you said we've all been quite contented to mean government, you meant really what the D.C. crowd.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the problems with WikiLeaks as opposed to an essay, in that because you're in a kind of informal dialogue with someone who you've talked about the same thing, you know, with before, it's too easy to just, you know, you throw out, well, you know, with a we, and John knew what I was talking about, but I can see where someone would think it's we Democrats and we're trying to conspire to create a compliant citizenry.
I think any serious charitable reading of your email would understand what you meant without it having to be explained as we just did.
And one of the things that's rampant out there is a lack of charity. And so, and so you can't, one can't expect to be treated kindly. And I got 35 or 40, nasty emails directed at me based on the published sort of misinterpretation of what I was trying to say. But I think people on the right, particularly the most anxious and kind of paranoid ones, are just trolling for phrases or words that they can pick up and attack. And I guess mine filled the bill.
Nice. Good evening, yes. Less is more.
The riots and civil unrest went down about 4 years ago. You promised us federal funding to rebuild our community. What happened?
Well, what happened was that we all knew that was going to be big news for a while, so we all came down here, Bush, Clinton, Wilson, all of us. We got our pictures taken, told you what you wanted to hear, and we We pretty much forgot about it.
Did he just say what I think he said?
Let's see where he's going with this.
Down here. We can't get health insurance, fire insurance, life insurance. Why haven't you come out for Senate Bill 2720?
Well, because you haven't really contributed any money to my campaign, have you? You got any idea how much these insurance companies come up with? They pretty much depend on me to get a bill like that and bottle it up in my committee during an election. And in that way, we can kill it when you're not looking.
Fred, when you say buy the book, what book would that be?
Are you saying the Democratic Party don't care about the African-American community?
Isn't that obvious? Hey, you got half of your kids out of work and the other half are in jail. Do you see any Democrat doing anything about it? Certainly not me. So what are you going to do, vote Republican? Come on. You're not going to vote Republican. Let's call a spade a spade. I mean, come on. You can have a billion man march. If you don't put down that malt liquor and chicken wings and get behind somebody other than a running back who stabs his wife, you're never going to get rid of somebody like me.
Fire!
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the right and the left and the culture war that's going on and how that might contribute to this unawareness and ignorance of real politics is in the population. One of the things about you that's interesting to me is that, well, you're the former head of the NEA, and that is a very important institution in the larger culture war.
Yes.
When I think of the NEA, I think of Piss Christ and a variety of other scandals or controversies that involve the NEA. How do you think that the culture war has contributed to this, construction of an unaware compliant citizenry or the meaning of our politics?
Well, I think, the culture wars or the culture war was a phrase that was very much in play back when I became chairman of the NEA in the late 1990s. And at that time, artists were very much seen as part of a kind of liberal or left-wing, urban, sexually open category of citizen that was dangerous to the American way, or certainly dangerous to people who were concerned about religion and abortion issues, and so on. And it's fascinating to me that the term culture war seems to be a kind of semi-empty vessel that can be filled up with different things depending on the time that you're in. And I think right now the arts have kind of been moved aside, and it's been replaced by more issues around gun rights and, of course, the constant right to life abortion rights issue, and a kind of elite against the working man configuration of conflict that really wasn't there so much back in the 1990s. But now I think there's a very strong sense that there's a whole category of people, Democratic and Republican, conservative and liberal, who have been left out of the economy, left out of a sense of social and lifestyle progress. And that while the elites have not only made too many of the rules, but they've continued to do well and to do better and better, and so it's almost the crust of civilization is now in conflict with everyman, and that's like I think a new configuration of the culture war. I think it's very challenging. And when I talked to John, when I mentioned to John in my email, this deserves attention and it's not going to be easy. That's what I was talking about. In other words, how do you, first of all, actually help people who feel that they've been neglected and whose lifestyles haven't improved? How do you help them do better? And then how do you repair the relationship between the elites who have the levers of power and finance? How do you repair the relationship between those people and the often good work they do, and and everyday Americans who are too often told again and again that those people at the top can't be trusted. So I think what I would say today is we have a culture war, but it's a new one. It's reconfigured from the one that I had to deal with when it was more symbolic, less economic, and perhaps more around the constellation of religion and certain practices and the perception of how artists did or did not fit into the American experience.
Well, don't you think that the rural white American culture was the culture that was offended by Piss Christ and other NEA projects, and that the urban, more sophisticated and more ethnically diverse culture was on the other side of that even then?
Perhaps. I think maybe it hadn't quite the dismay and distrust on the part of everyday working people in rural parts of the country, aimed at the elites. I don't think it quite solidified that way, but I think the elements, as you suggest, were definitely, very definitely there. And it will be an interesting challenge to try to turn that around. One of my biggest fears about the election that will be held soon is that Hillary Clinton will win. She perhaps even will win big.
Mm-hmm.
And then the leadership class will heave a big sigh of relief and put their feet up and say, we really dodged a bullet, and just start talking to each other again. And we'll kind of be back to where we were. And I think that denies the fact that at the deep down in the inappropriate and sort of dismaying construct that is Donald Trump, there's a germ of an important idea, which is lots and lots of people feel on the outside, lots of people feel neglected, lots of people feel they're not really part of the process. Mm-hmm. And I think if my party, if Democrats win, and we just move on as though sort of nothing had happened and get back to what we would call business as usual, I think we'll be missing not only an opportunity, but a real need, a time when we should all get together and try to do better.
Just the other day, actually yesterday, in the Chronicle of Higher Education, there was an article by an author named Lee Drutman, and it just came across my Facebook feed today, so I was looking at it before we got together on the phone here, and he puts forward this idea that the whole notion of a rational, independent voter is an antiquated one, and that the reality is people vote demographically and they vote based on identity, and that we have to come up with strategies to deal with that reality, especially in the face of something like Trump, who largely seems to be playing to white rural identity. Do you think that we need to take into account these cultural demarcations and these identities and take them more seriously?
I think they should be taken into account. I think they have been taken into account, and I think perhaps they've been taken into account to excess. I would disagree with the argument that the intelligent, informed voter has gone away.
Mm-hmm.
We don't interrogate people today to find out what they're really thinking. We advertise to them. We send messages to them. We make assumptions about how those messages and advertisements will produce effects based on demographic assumptions. And underlying it, there's a kind of undemocratic contempt for mankind. If people are only their demography, then democracy really doesn't work, because then those blocks of people can, in fact, consistently be tricked by what are basically advertising and public relations techniques that have become, in 21st century, in a 21st century market economy, they've become extraordinarily powerful and extraordinarily accelerated by all forms of new media. And I think the challenge is not to give up and say, oh yeah, it's all demography, let's just count and figure out who is going to do what. The challenge is to get behind or beneath demography and media and find out what people are really thinking. There are a number of we're beginning to try to look at community in new ways. I mean, there's been kind of a reassessment of Jane Jacobs and talking about how she's looked at not only cityscapes, but the way people living together was an essential component of democracy, face-to-face encounters. Those are the things that have been going away. And I think one of the challenges for policy actors today is to find a way to build human interaction that cuts across these lines of difference back into community. The town I grew up in, and this had gone by the time I was a kid, there were vestiges of it, but when my parents were young in this mining town in far northern Michigan, if you worked in a grocery store, you had to have five or six languages because you were dealing with really, really different people all the time, and people live next to one another. And now we engage our friends through media where we make choices of who we're going to talk to. We live in gated communities or communities with psychological and financial gates around them. And we do everything in our power to get in our sort of ethnic, demographic, nationality, racial, sexual track, stay there, and not look left or right. And in a society that structures itself that way, will have a great deal of difficulty functioning as an effective democracy.
You know, Zero Books is a very left-wing publisher, and I tend to mostly talk to extremely left-wing people most of the time and think from the left. But lately, really maybe since the rise of Trump, I've decided to try to engage with the right a little bit, mostly out of fear of the alt-right. But recently I had a conversation with a YouTuber who considers himself to be on the right and a traditionalist. He's a Catholic. He's very strongly anti-abortion and many other things that you might expect. One thing that he said was that he had a vision that we kind of agreed that, like, I'm a socialist and I have a vision for the future of a different kind of society. And he does too. But his vision was one in which it was founded mostly on shared cultural and moral and religious values between people living in a community that were high trust communities and where ideas and opinions and policies and all of that could be formulated more openly and without all these class divisions and what he thinks of as sort of problems that are imposed by the left on communities, but which I think are not that, but nonetheless, that was his vision, and it had to do, I think, with wanting to return to a common culture.
I have often found, working with my progressive leftist friends, and I'm a kind of a neo-Marxian myself, at least in terms of analyzing the situation that we're in now. I think we're in late capitalism, and we're suffering from all the ills of late capitalism. Whether socialism and communism offers some kind of a model for actually governing people, I think is a more than open question. I don't think it works. And I don't like Marx's theory of historical change, but I really like the critique of our current methods of production and the economy and the way that might be, the way it might be framed. I think one of the challenges that American intellectuals have never quite taken on, and it's daunting, and I struggle with it myself. I wrote a third book called Handmaking America that came out in 2012. It was a little more political than Arts, Inc. And was beginning to think about, what's the cement in the American experience that allows us to call ourselves American and have a shared experience without falling into the nationalist trap that, say, a country like France finds itself in. And if you have a country like the U.S. that is almost like a metaphorical border with all of these different people living here and contesting with one another and competing for a place and a role and all of these things going on, but somehow kind of making it work. I mean, with all of, one would think to look at police issues or issues of income and employment and so on over the last 5 years, that this country is a disaster. I think Donald Trump plays to that notion. It's not a disaster. We have lots of problems, but we're also highly functional. The thing that we've never done is found a way to talk about the togetherness, the cement, the center of the American experience. What is the American cultural identity? And I'm using culture in one of its four or five different meanings, but I think you know what I mean. France and Germany, these countries, they kind of have it easy. They say, oh, yeah, it's kind of a racial, ethnic, and, shared nationality. And France can't even deal with, has terrible times with immigrants. They can't even deal with people who were raised in its own colonies and who speak French. And it's because there's such a certain sense of Frenchness. We've never had that sense of Americanness. My hope is that somewhere on the horizon, there's a way of intellectualizing the American experience in an inspiring way that talks about how, even though we're so different, there's something there that binds us. I remember, it might have been a comic, maybe an African American comic, who said, that he'd walk into a bar in Italy, and the second he would walk in, everybody would say, oh, there's an American. Well, he didn't know what they were spotting. Maybe they didn't know what they were spotting, but there was something in style, manner, way of interaction that was uniquely American. But we tend to look at ourselves as a diverse society and see that primarily as a perpetual rolling set of problems to be solved, rather than something that really is our advantage, if we could only talk about it in a way that causes everybody to stand up and say, aha, I get it.
On this point, do you think that the right wing has, do you think they have a point that the left is too quick to emphasize differences and especially maybe along racial or gender lines to want to demarcate experiences off and not seek out any kind of universal connection?
I wouldn't frame it that way. I would say that for me and for my leftist friends, we're probably a little too contemptuous of cultural heritage, the weight of history, the value of connecting with the past and connecting horizontally with community. Well, I think we tend to think, particularly in the shadow of Marx, that if we kind of solve the money issue and the employment issue and sort of the means of production in our society, then all of the other things will take care of themselves. Everything is a subset of the economy. I think the other way. I think culture, and particularly cultural heritage, is the most important thing. And so I would give my conservative friends this much credit. I think on an instinctive level, they are onto something. I think they realize that there are sources of meaning in life other than just money and the things money can buy, and how the system can be manipulated to make the distribution of those things as equitable as is possible. In Arts Inc., and then in a little more elaborate detail in Handmaking America, I put forward this idea of something called expressive life, which for me is a kind of a phrase that substitutes for much of the talk about culture. And for me, expressive life has four things in it. It has heritage and religion, which are about the past and community, and it has political speech and personal creative practice, which is about who you are as an individual, where you want to be, how you connect with your leadership. And I think if those things are all in balance, if an individual or a community is connected with heritage, religion has an appropriate place, if there is healthy political speech, and if people have access to the tools of personal creative practice, you can craft a high quality of life. It doesn't have to be a life of wealth. And I think all policy actors have kind of neglected things away from, aside from material well-being, as avenues for solving the way we live. And my problem with my conservative friends is they just default to some very simplistic, sloganistic notions of what the problems are and what should happen. And they have to do with religion and certain hot button issues like right to life and so on. And they don't really dig in to the very real challenges that can be, that will result if you just give into religion. Well, you know, I always make fun of the Gates Foundation, of course, because their slogan is, you know, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve a chance to live a healthy, productive life. Well, that they're the dominant foundation. They're the dominant sort of private NGO intervener in quality of life. Well, if you parse that slogan, it's, you know, dedicated to the idea that people have a chance, not a right, but a chance to live a life that's healthy and productive. Well, health is a sort of, you know, it's a necessity if you're going to be productive. So it's really about everybody deserves a chance to have a job. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's a very, very low target if you're talking about a high quality of life for all. And I think one of our challenges is to move off of that purely materialistic target in defining quality of life and think about something that's bigger and has more moving parts. And that's sort of my argument. And for me, it circles back to cultural vitality as a public good, something that we really don't honor much in the U.S. And perhaps on a global basis, we don't honor it the way we should.
You know, if you take the Gates Foundation's slogan absolutely literally, there's no need for the Gates Foundation because everyone does have a chance.
Yeah,
right? However small it may be.
On Tuesday, January 19th, 2016 at 8:19 p.m., Jake Sullivan wrote, "Team, there is appetite for a call on healthcare tomorrow. The idea would be to get someone, Ken Thorpe, to join Brian Fallon to make the following points. Senator Sanders couldn't have thought this through. Otherwise he would never have put forward a plan that hurts many poor people on Medicaid right now. Hurts many working seniors. Hurts many young people under 26. We assume that he will fix these things because this just makes no sense."
From the magazine Medium, we learned that this email was sent a week before a damaging, highly critical analysis of Bernie Sanders' single-payer healthcare plan was released by healthcare expert Kenneth Thorpe, with no disclosure of any affiliation with any campaign. Thorpe's analysis was reported by Vox on January 28 in an article titled "Study: Bernie Sanders' single-payer plan is almost twice as expensive as he says."
I wanted to comment on this division between economics and culture, and from a kind of a wannabe Marxist perspective, which is mine, I always think of it like this, is that we have to develop a culture of solidarity between mostly working people to be able to take on the challenges of the economic situation and the economic inequity that's built into our society. So you can't do without a culture of solidarity and a common culture, even in struggle against economic difficulties.
I agree, except when we talk about a culture of solidarity, I don't think history has demonstrated that it can be achieved by uniting workers. I'm particularly interested in, you know, entities like the Highlander Folk School in the South. Started in the 1930s as a labor school. And the idea was that, you know, you bring black and white workers together, that the shared interests of workers were sufficiently strong to cut across differences of community, ethnicity, even race. And I think history has demonstrated that it's not that strong. I mean, I don't think it's worked that well in China. Of course, Russia didn't really start with the workers, you know. But I think this idea of finding a mechanism of solidarity that isn't chauvinistic and nationalistic, xenophobic, that really brings people together. I think that's the big challenge for the U.S. Solidarity, of course, sounds kind of Marxist, but I think that that's, you know, it's a sense of how do you work to encourage a sense of togetherness and unity that allows people to be different, but still realizes by being different in one place and kind of, you know, aiming at the same ends in terms of quality of life, that we can have the admirable society that actually we still have. I mean, this is still a much admired society, even when we stumble. And at times it's been truly a beacon. And I think we can play that kind of role again.
Well, I'm going to ask you two more questions, and then okay. I'll let you go. So the next question I have is this. Do you think that the emergence of Trump represents a crisis in our culture as well as in our political life? Or any kind of crisis at all.
I think it does represent a crisis in our political life, and I think it may be somewhat grounded in what we've already been chatting about, which is a certain set of, you know, of looming cultural realities. I think if you have a society that goes along for half a century or a century, defining quality of life as income and wealth, defining success as consumption, you start to set up the possibility of certain kinds of conflict, because those things are not going to be allocated equally in a, you know, in a market economy. If at the same time, the political system that you have runs by campaigning against leadership. Every political opponent says Washington is terrible. Every political aspirant is going to change it, transform it. Every government worker is incompetent or lazy. Government has no business. Government is not the solution. It's the problem, et cetera, et cetera. If you do that for 25 or 30 years, and if inexplicably you take things like history and denigrate history and literature as fields of study, wanting to replace them with sort of technocratic skills that are good perhaps in some parts of the workforce, and at the same time you no longer teach civics. I don't know where that, somewhere civics went away. It was there when I was a kid and now it's gone.
Yeah.
But you take all that together, and what you have, I think, are the societal or even the cultural underpinnings of what becomes a political crisis. And Donald Trump will lose. I hope he loses big. Mm-hmm. I hope it's a message. But the Republican Party will be shattered, and it will have a very tough time rebuilding itself. I don't know what will come into the void. And so in that empty space, anything can happen. Trump was dangerous in part because he appealed to a very visceral, very critical concern among millions of people about how the government was working. He failed because he's a terrible person. But I can imagine a more nuanced figure with some of the same arguments and without the same kind of baggage, who could do tremendous damage to the political system in a long-term way. And I think everybody should be, and this goes back to my comment to John in the WikiLeaked email, is that this is a problem that everybody, left and right, has to think really hard about. Unless you're in that subset that would really like to see the American democracy kind of stumble and fail.
One, a friend of mine said, you know, Trump is Barry Goldwater, and now we have to watch for Reagan.
Sure.
That's what I'm quite concerned about. But I'm fairly critical, very critical, really, of your friends in the Clinton campaign. And I feel as though, well, here's a couple of facts from WikiLeaks. This is my final question for you. You know, at the outset, you said that both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party were culpable for setting up this political system where we play to people's prejudices and preconceptions and cultural identities and so forth. And I see this campaign as one in which the big beneficiary of Trump's rise has been the Clinton campaign, that without it, Clinton may not have done as well. This is something the Clinton campaign seemed to want, at least in early days, according to WikiLeaks documents. So I wonder if there's any chance at all that the Democratic Party will take on board the risk that this kind of politics unleashes into, you know, to the body politic, that whether, you know, when you destroy the Republican Party and the moderate base of the Republican Party and you open up a vacuum, that does the Democratic Party see this as a dangerous moment, or are they celebrating? And so this is my question to you. To what extent do Democrats see themselves as partly responsible for the way that our politics have become debased?
I can speak for myself and say that I think that most of the debasement has come from the right. But I would say that everyone is somewhat culpable in that there is a Washington establishment, as there has been for many, many decades. In fact, in some ways, if you go back to the 1940s, when all you had were white men from, you know, six different colleges running the government, it was probably much more incestuous. But I do think there is a danger that this will wipe the sweat off the brow and heave a sigh and say we dodged a bullet and let's continue with business as usual. There are some forces out there that we've never had to deal with before. I mean, one is the power of media, both, you know, on the Twitter, Facebook side and on the Fox News, MSNBC side. We've just never had that coming at us. I'm ambivalent about the WikiLeaks leaks thus far, because by far most of them I consider to be just kind of the routine way that any political campaign would operate and the kinds of things political people would say. We don't have the equivalent from the Trump or the primary campaigns in the Republican Party to see what their conversations online were like. Obviously, I mean, WikiLeaks is, I guess I always think of it as being something that's intended to be a whistleblower. That is, it finds a problem and then it reveals the underpinnings of that problem to the public, and, you know, so therefore it might get solved. In this case, this seems to be something different. It seems to be not as directly purposeful, more just of a blast. Here's all this stuff. Although I think it's certainly curated to some degree. It's not just everything. And it also, I don't know that WikiLeaks by itself at this time, with Julian Assange in Ecuador, I don't know what capacity they have to actually do anything themselves. So my suspicion is somebody had to hand this to them.
Oh yeah. Well, that's always the case.
So there's that whole thing. But I'm not really dodging the question, but I think it is an open question. And I think the dangers are that the danger will not really be seen. There's such a tendency in politics to think in programs rather than vision, in issues rather than long-term objectives, and to think in things of 1, 2, and 4 year blocks of election cycles or one day news cycles. And it's almost, and this is a nonpartisan observation. Mm-hmm. It's just if you step back in a setting of political insiders and start talking about what we're trying to do for the American people and how does this fit long term, and yes, here's your project or your program, but what's the vision? What's the overarching vision that justifies that program? People look at you like you're from Mars. And I think it's we have pulled politics and government down to what works in a news cycle or what works in an election cycle, and anything bigger is just seen as dangerous territory. And in fact, if you talk about a vision in a political speech, there's a very decent chance that the so-called experts will make fun of you, mm-hmm. you know, that it's not practical. What are they talking about? And so there are these, I think, very bad forces in play that somebody smart will have to kind of push against, find a way to push. And I think it may be, maybe the Center for American Progress working with the American Enterprise Institute on citizenship and government and going at it from both sides. Uh-huh. But that's what's going to take. I agree with you. I mean, I think that that there are, you know, indications of this kind of cynical manipulation of system rather than leadership and good government. And so many of, Twitter to Fox News to MSNBC play into that.
The moment for me in WikiLeaks that really made my blood boil when it came to the Clinton administration, or I'm going to just call it the Clinton administration now. I read an interview with Hillary Clinton one day where she said, what we want in any election cycle are the two most moderate, sane, and skilled candidates from both parties running. But then if you look into the actual sausage making, you see that her campaign was quite happy to have the least moderate, the least competent, and the most dangerous candidate get the nomination for the Republican Party. And I just think there was something fundamental. I mean, I feel like I'm being naive in a way to be upset about that. Of course, that's how politics are run. That's not surprising. But on the other hand, it is troubling. It really profoundly disturbing that the politics have gotten, not just for Hillary Clinton, but for most, gotten to a point where what's best for the country is often put aside for what's best for the political campaign.
Yeah, and the problem is that the WikiLeaks leaks stand alone. You know, we can't look at other campaigns in other times and other parties and see what the equivalent were.
Equivalent I can think of is Nixon, and Muskie.
I agree, but that's the other one we've seen. In other words, that the question that gets begged is the process of getting somebody elected always fairly calculating and somewhat cynical? That's just the way that has to happen, going back to, Honest Abe.
Okay.
We have no way of knowing what lies behind.
We choose the right format. We leak the information to the public. And we defend ourselves against inevitable legal and political attacks. WikiLeaks. Lead me.
The world.